In the last lecture, the English people appeared to have achieved political stability, economic prosperity, and the most equitable society in Europe by 1714. But as we've seen, this came at the expense of peoples outside of England who had yet to taste the benefits of English liberty and prosperity. This lecture ends the course with a few more words about the significance of those developments and the whole of English history under the Tudors and Stuarts, particularly for Americans in the 21st century. It will argue that by 1714, the English people had not only achieved a degree of material comfort, but had pioneered many of the ideas and attitudes which we carry around as moderns and for which we fought in the American Revolution and every war since. These shared ideals do not absolve the people we've studied of their many failings any more than they absolve us of ours, but I'll argue that they have provided the tools with which they, those they failed, and we, their intellectual descendants, could fight for a better, more just society on both sides of the Atlantic. The society described in the preceding lectures had many problems. Even at the end of our period, as the Walpolean political stability reigned, it should be clear that that stability was built upon great inequalities in politics, in religion, in economic realities, in social relations. As we saw in Lecture 46, this was a society in which the have-nots still far outnumbered the haves, in which most of the efforts of 98% of the people seemed geared to providing a leisurely and fulfilling life for the blessed 2% at the top, in which that wealthy 2% nevertheless lived in constant fear that the poor majority would rise up and take away their material wealth and status, in which that majority were perfectly happy to exploit that fear to secure concessions from the minority, and in which even their relative prosperity was to some extent built upon the enslavement of Africans, the expulsion from their lands of Native Americans, the oppression of the Catholic Irish, and a system in which every person lorded it over his or her social inferior, no matter how few, and in which every man lorded it over every woman of comparable rank. No wonder that Henry Fielding defined the word nobody in 1752 as all the people in Great Britain, except about 1,200. Which should raise a question. If, after all the sound and fury, constitutional arguments, wars and rebellions of the Tudor and Stuart centuries, they couldn't engineer a just and equitable society, what have we been doing for these 48 lectures? Why should we care about these people? Why should we study them? What do they have to tell us, struggling with our own issues of justice and equity in the 21st century? Is this not, as some critics have alleged, ultimately a story of dead white men and a few dead white women who got to live nice lives off of the sweat of others and who sought only their own advantage? Now, whether or not you feel those questions are fair and interesting, every historian of England has to confront them. That confrontation is especially pressing if the historian in question happens to be an American. What am I doing studying these people? What am I doing studying somebody else's history? How can I justify telling somebody else's story? Needless to say, over the last 20 years, I've had to come up with a few answers, and I'm going to share them with you today. The first reason to study England and its people from the Tudors to the Stuarts remains what it always was and what should by now be obvious. This is a great story, as if you need reminding. It's the story of how part of a small island in 1485, poorer than contemporary Belgium, less powerful than contemporary Denmark, rose over 250 years to be the wealthiest and most powerful nation on earth. It's the story of how it produced a great culture, giving the world More's Utopia, Shakespeare's plays, Milton's Paradise Lost, Purcell's Odes and Anthems, Wren's Buildings, Newton's Science, the King James Bible, and arguably its greatest city, London. You thought I was going to say Basingstoke, didn't you? And such universally beloved institutions as the pub, the coffee house, the club, stage actresses, the newspaper, a free press, and real ale. If these are all just names to you, you must really sample at least some of them. Now, Admittedly, many of these institutions existed to bring English men and women together who were otherwise very much apart. They existed to obscure the differences and lubricate the tensions of a society which was often quite tension-filled because of that strong hierarchy we talked about earlier. But still, they're positive things, and those of us who live in a society that needs an easing of its tension benefit from them. Think of the English language itself, and what a powerful tool it has been to enlighten or inspire. That became possible because in our period it evolved from prose, well, like this. Your grace is grown in great choleric fashion whensoever you are contraried in that which you have conceived in your head. Guess what I do to students who write like that? To this. I've tried him drunk, I've tried him sober. There's nothing in him. Or, know then thyself, presume not God to scan, the proper study of mankind is man. Or this. The raising or keeping a standing army within the kingdom in time of peace, unless it be with the consent of Parliament, is against the law. That's from the Declaration of Rights of 1689. Read or listen to any great American political speech, Patrick Henry's Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death, Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, King's I Have a Dream, and you will see and hear the cadences and vocabulary of Shakespeare, the Book of Common Prayer, the King James Bible, the language of Magna Carta, the English Common Law, and the great statutes of the 17th century. This is a story of how a resourceful people survived. They survived repeated epidemics and famines, one failed invasion and two successful ones, two civil wars, a series of violent reformations and counter-reformations in religion, a social and two political revolutions. It's the story of how they faced down the two most powerful monarchs on earth, Philip II of Spain and Louis XIV of France. This is the story of how the English people stumbled into a constitutional monarchy, religious toleration, and the freest, most participatory society in Europe, if not quite a democracy. In the 1720s, François-Marie Arouet, better known as Voltaire, found himself exiled to England because he had written something critical of the kings of France. He couldn't stay in his own country. In England, he was shocked to discover the relative openness of English life. He was shocked to discover that a merchant family could rise into the peerage, that peers thought nothing of investing in trading voyages or mines or stocks, often in partnership with regular merchants. A French aristocrat would think that beneath him. He was shocked that anybody could frequent a coffee house and hobnob with a duke. He was shocked that a man is by no means exempt from paying certain taxes here simply because he is a noble or because he is a priest. He was shocked that the press could satirize the Prime Minister as Bob Booty or the Prime Master General, admittedly at some risk, as we indicated in the last lecture. He was shocked that ordinary people could protest the price of grain without facing the noose. Of course, we all know that they might face it if they actually stole some. That they could complain of their landlords and of their MPs or of the king discreetly without ruining their lives. Above all, he saw that English law applied to everyone equally. You will hear nothing here about high, middle, or low justice, or of the right to hunt over the land of a citizen who has no right to fire a shot in his own field. You couldn't do it. Somebody's property was their property, whether they were the poorest man in the kingdom and you were the wealthiest. In 1733, he published all of this, his findings, in The Letters on England. In this book, he tried to explain to his countrymen religious toleration, the English Constitution, the political theories of John Locke, the scientific theories of Sir Isaac Newton, the inoculation for the smallpox. This book is now largely forgotten today, but it's often credited with starting the European Enlightenment and so planting the seeds which would flower in the French Revolution. Of course, this all started in England. This is a story filled with remarkable personalities. Thomas More dying the king's good servant, but God's first. Elizabeth rallying her troops against the Spanish Empire with the heart and stomach of a king. James I telling Parliament that I will not be content that my power be disputed upon. Sir Jacob Astley at Edge Hill begging his lord not to forget me if I forget thee. March on, boys. Matthew Prior rating the monuments of his master's actions over those of the Sun King. Or Sir Robert Walpole flourishing a Norfolk apple to deflect criticism of his policies in Parliament. For many viewers and listeners of these tapes, it will be these great moments that most enliven the story and that you will probably most remember, if you remember anything. But for me, the real meaning of this story is not to be found in the words and experiences of the rich men and women who ran the place, but in those of the countless ordinary people who didn't leave us their names, but who struggled to survive and prosper, and who along the way made of England under the Tudors and the Stuarts something greater than it had been in 1485. The real meaning of this story, for Americans especially, is to be found not in this royal throne of kings, or even in the heroism of Bishop Latimer lighting a candle by God's grace in England as shall never be put out. But I find it in Parliament telling the king, we most truly avouch that our privileges and liberties are our rights and due inheritance, no less than our very lands and goods. Edward Cook, MP, asserting, we serve here for thousands and ten thousands. Denzel Hall as MP exclaiming, zounds, you shall sit as long as this house pleases. Above all, in the words of ordinary people who never sat in Parliament, that unknown complainer who said, there are too many gentlemen in England by 500. The recorder of Taunton who stood up to one of Buckingham's captains. Every man knows there's no law for this, billeting soldiers. We know our houses are our castles. The new model army, an army of citizen soldiers who claimed that they served, quote, in the defense of our own and the people's just rights and liberties. And of course, my favorite, Colonel Rainsborough, asserting when John Locke was only a little boy that the poorest he that is in England has a life to live as the greatest he, and therefore that every man that is to live under a government ought first by his own consent to put himself under that government. There was the anonymous toaster to our sovereign lord, the people. And I suppose if I were going to sneak in one monarch, it would be Queen Anne at the end of her reign, thinking of the good of her people. In so doing, all these people remind us that English history is as much about the ruled as it is about the rulers. Perhaps the most quotable of those rulers was Oliver Cromwell. But this course is ultimately less about the Cromwell who wrote, God made them as stubble to our swords, and certainly not the one who thought the massacres of Drogheda and Wexford a righteous judgment of God, but the one who said, relieve the oppressed, hear the groans of the poor prisoners, be pleased to reform the abuses of the professions, and if there be any that makes many poor to make a few rich, that suits not a commonwealth. Those words ring as true today as they did then. Now, you may have signed up for this course for kings and queens, and I hope that I haven't disappointed you. But its real meaning, the meaning of English history for Americans and for all people, I think, is that old Platonic struggle to build a commonwealth, to build a just state. Now, that struggle had many setbacks. It's still not done. As I've been at pains to point out, it should never be forgotten that the victories and advances that we've been talking about all through this course were built on the backs of Africans who were abducted, sold, enslaved, and worked to an early grave. Native Americans who were displaced and sometimes slaughtered in their own country. Catholic Irish who were displaced, marginalized, and reduced to penury in their own country. English dissenters made into second-class citizens and English Catholics made into third-class citizens in their own country, even in the tolerant 18th century. Vast numbers of ordinary people who worked for little so that the upper 2% might have leisure. Women, one half of the population whose voices were left unheard. Britain and its former colonies in North America are still dealing with the legacy of these injustices. But this course has equally tried to be about the English fight and the English fighters against those injustices. While England under the Tudors and Stuarts can hardly be called a just or equitable society, it was a society which gave us many of the ideals, the models, and the tools with which to achieve one. It's that common inheritance, more than anything else, that explains this famous, vaunted, special relationship we have for each other. After all, early modern English men and women taught the world that absolute monarchy was not the only viable form of government. At least they taught their own early modern world that. They argued for the first time since the Greeks that rulers should be answerable to the people they ruled through their representative institutions. They asserted that citizens could not be imprisoned without charge, the right of habeas corpus, that they had to be that they could not be tried without access to a jury, that they couldn't be taxed without the permission of their representatives, that they couldn't be subject to martial law or forced to billet soldiers. It was the people of England who first in the early modern world won or extended widely the right to vote, the right to express political opinions in speech or print, the right to sack a ruler who failed to govern them justly or effectively. The rest of Europe thought that they were nuts. England was thought to be the sick man of Europe in the 17th century. It was really Spain. England was thought to be this collection of crazies who couldn't be ruled. But when early modern English people spoke of the rights of an Englishman, they knew that no similar phrase existed anywhere else in Europe. Try it out. The rights of a Frenchman, the rights of a Russian. You couldn't say that in the 17th century or the 18th century. It was, moreover, the people of England who demonstrated to the early modern world that women could rule just as effectively as men. Indeed, it could be argued that the most able and successful rulers in this course, the most able and successful rulers in Britain's history, have been women. In contrast, Europe would actually go to war in 1740, the War of the Austrian Succession, because a woman, Maria Theresa, had the temerity to inherit the Austrian throne. Now, admittedly, early modern English men and women came later to the idea of religious toleration than the Dutch or the Poles. Even when they did, it was a limited toleration within a Protestant framework. But eventually, gradually, after the horrors of the Civil War, they did reject persecution and zealotry, and that rejection would work a quiet revolution of tolerance in the countryside. And let us not forget that in America, English men and women were constructing a society made up of all shades of religious opinion. Above all, far more than any other contemporary European society, English men and women, under the Tudors and the Stuarts, proved that social class was not immutable, that intelligence, ambition, and ability could lead to a career, a fortune, or burial in Westminster Abbey. Among those in this course who achieved greatness, or at least status from humble backgrounds, Cardinal Wolsey, Thomas Cromwell, William Shakespeare, Oliver Cromwell, Samuel Pepys, Abigail Masham, who rose into the peerage, and a lot of those artists who were making a living and sometimes achieving knighthoods in the England of the late 17th and early 18th century. If it should never be forgotten that English men and women perpetrated great crimes against humanity under the Tudors and the Stuarts, then it should equally be remembered that many of them died or suffered fighting for and over the ideals with which to right those crimes. When Americans took up arms against George III in 1775, they did so in defense of these English ideals. Now, admittedly, those ideals were only partially or barely realized in 1714 or 1775, or even today. It would be many years before they positively affected most people's lives, either there or here. The slave trade wasn't outlawed in the British Empire until 1807. Catholics and dissenters were not freed from the prohibitions of the Test Act until 1830. The middle class didn't get the vote until the Reform Act of 1832. The working class until the 1880s. Women on both sides of the Atlantic until the early 20th century. In Britain, it could be argued that the Commonwealth men's and levelers' most cherished ideals for a state that promoted the welfare of the people were not implemented until after World War II. In America, maybe until President Johnson's Great Society programs of the 1960s, and we all know that both have been under siege ever since. And of course, Britain has spent most of the 20th century working out the logic of the ideas of men like John Locke in finally, grudgingly recognizing the independence of the Republic of Ireland in 1937, India in 1947, and most of the rest of the British Empire thereafter. There is an irony here. In the 19th century, when the British Empire was at its height, Cecil Rhodes founded the Rhodes Scholarship to educate the leaders of colonial societies as well as America at Oxford. His idea was that there, at Oxford, at the mother of all English-speaking universities, these young men and later women would come to appreciate the blessings of the English Constitution, the English legal tradition, English culture, and therefore the blessings of being a part of the British Empire by learning the story that we have just told. Now, in fact, most of that did happen. At Oxford, these young men and young women studied the Magna Carta, the development of Parliament, the British Civil Wars and the Glorious Revolution, the English constitutional tradition, the writings of Thomas More and William Shakespeare and John Locke. And you know what they concluded from all that study? That they and their people wanted the same degree of self-government, individual rights, tolerance, democracy, liberty, equality, to which every early modern English man and woman aspired, even if they never really got there. As you know, it hasn't always quite worked out that way in Africa or Asia or any of the former British colonies. But that does nothing to discredit the nobility of these ideals. Finally, there's the country that first shirked its British loyalties, the United States. The great 19th century British political commentator, Walter Bagehot, referred to us as our, that is, Britain's nearest national kindred. It's about the nicest thing he actually said about us, actually. Indeed, as you all know, our original 13 states began as crown colonies. When they rebelled against King George III, they claimed that they were doing so in defense of English liberties. Specifically, the martial law and billeting provisions of the Petition of Right of 1628. The free trade within the empire represented by the Navigation Acts. And above all, the principle defended throughout this course and finally enshrined in the English Declaration of Rights that an Englishman could not be taxed without his permission. As Bernard Bailyn and others have shown, revolutionary pamphleteers cited in their defense Francis Bacon, Edward Coke, John Milton's political writings, Algernon Sidney, and of course, John Locke, endlessly. All of those writings were forged in the crucible of the political struggles that we've been talking about in this course, the political struggles of Stuart England. When, in 1768, British troops arrived in Boston, the Boston town meeting reacted in language that would have been familiar to any 17th century parliamentarian. Here's what they said. The raising or keeping a standing army within the kingdom in time of peace, unless it be with the consent of Parliament, is against the law. Sound familiar? It's a direct lift from a quote I read earlier from the Declaration of Rights of 1689. The colonists were going back to that English constitutional tradition, and in this case, the writings of John Lord Somers, to make their case to an English king. Now, as you know, the United States won its independence, in part because the British Empire was overextended in the 1770s and 80s, but also in part because many Englishmen, particularly most of the Whig Party in Parliament in those years, agreed with us. In the midst of that struggle, we embraced a Declaration of Independence, propounded on the Leveller and Lockean principles. that all men should have a say in putting themselves under a government. That government exists to protect the life, the liberty, and the property of its citizens. Now, I know that Jefferson obfuscated this, but make no mistake, those men in that convention were men of property. And that when government fails to do so, as in 1688, the people have a just right of revolt. Above all, it was Jefferson's genius to summarize and state outright that which was implied in all of this struggle for all of these principles. All men are created equal. Subsequently, the founding fathers, as solid a group of English country gentlemen as you're ever going to find, sought to create a constitution which embodied the strengths of the English one while correcting what, in their view, were its defects. Even that correction, no monarch, no state church, decentralized power to the states, rights of free speech, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly, the right to bear arms, etc., all of those, where do they come from? They came out of distinctly English experiences that we've been describing all through this lecture course. The royal attempts at absolute rule versus the experiment with an English republic. The experience of religious persecution versus freedom during the civil wars. The Riot Act is freedom of assembly is a response to the 1715 Riot Act. The disarming of papists. To that we can owe the right to bear arms. In other words, the Constitution of the United States is an English history lesson. Now, as you know, we, like the English, have not always lived up to our English ideals. Our Constitution denied personhood to 2/5 of slaves. We had to fight a bloody civil war and a more recent fight over civil rights to bring that ideal of all men being created equal closer to reality. And I'm sure you would agree that that fight is not over. Anyone who argues that English ideals have still not been achieved on either side of the Atlantic will get no argument from me. But that doesn't reduce their nobility or the urgency of our task to make them real. Twice in the past century, Americans have seen it as part of that task to go to war on the same side as Britain to defend those very ideals. They, I submit, are the real inheritance of England from the Tudors to the Stuarts. And they have meant enough to us to send our sons and daughters to fight and to die for them. I began this course by quoting the most quotable of all Englishmen, William Shakespeare. I would like to end it with perhaps his one great 20th century rival. He was, like me, a historian of the reign of Queen Anne. Unlike me, he was a direct descendant of the Duke of Marlborough, the son of a cabinet minister who rose to be prime minister and the winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature. But I'm still young. What's often forgotten about Winston Churchill is that he was, on his mother's side, an American. His mother was the American heiress Jenny Jerome. In the dark days of 1941, Sir Winston famously said to his mother's countrymen, "Give us the tools, and we will finish the job." The tools for which Churchill was asking in 1941, as you all know, were, of course, material, ships, airplanes, guns, tanks with which to fight Hitler. But the job was to defend the political, social, and cultural inheritance of the Atlantic world. As this implies, the idealistic and conceptual tools and traditions that were necessary to achieve a just society, a democratic government, freedom of worship, and an open intellectual life, the inheritance that Churchill was trying to perpetuate against Hitler's legions, had long before been passed across the Atlantic in the opposite direction, from England to America. They existed, admittedly, sometimes only in embryonic form, sometimes only in the minds of their originators, but in but one place in 1714. They existed there thanks to the courage and the persistence of the people of England, from the Tudors to the Stuarts.